Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. Tonight, Aaron.
Great, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Check out our Patreon. It is always awesome. A new episode out called Death by Internet. We also have new items we'll be adding to our Gen Y shop. So go out to genypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
If you're like me and refuse to let go of your skinny jeans, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products. Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Tonight's case is a brutal murder of a family and friend. It's a possible wrongful conviction. Going to give our usual disclaimer of we do not follow narratives. We are not advocates. We're going to tell the story based on evidence.
So if you're familiar with this story and you are on one side or another, well, you may not like what we have to say because we're not on a side. What are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Well, tonight we're talking about the Chino Hills Massacre, also known as the Kevin Cooper case.
Some of you probably know that True Crime Garage covered this a while back, but hey, we're not going to let that stop us, right?
Yeah, it used to be when there were like 20 true crime podcasts, if we covered something and then they did or vice versa, we would get a bunch of emails. Why are you copying them? Or why are you just doing whatever they do? We stopped getting those messages.
Yeah, I can't even keep up with what all has been covered and what hasn't. So I just happened to go out and look and saw that they had covered it back in June or January or something.
Well, it's a case that definitely needs coverage. Let's start with talking about the family, the Ryans. The parents were Franklin and Peggy Ryan. They had met at an alumni reunion at Palmer in 1970. They were married on December 20th, 1970. Franklin was a former Marine and military policeman, and he was a farmer. Peggy Ryan was a chiropractor, just like her mother was. She opened up her own practice, and her husband, Franklin, even joined her at the clinic for a while in Santa Ana, California. They would end up moving after Peggy became pregnant and opening a clinic in Olympia, Washington. They also got into horses. They bought their first two Arabian horses soon after moving there, and then it seemed like that was their hobby.
I think they had up to 5 horses, and their neighbors weren't exactly fans of them living where they were at with this whole small farm in the backyard. So they'll end up moving to the Chino Hills area. But they were living in Santa Ana in a more residential area. So yeah, kind of interesting.
So they started to have some issues. These horses were very expensive for them, which meant that they sold their prior home in Santa Ana. Their practice wasn't doing very well, I guess. Now they ended up moving to Chino Hills, and they had a 5-acre property with a hilltop ranch. It seemed like they had different properties. They had these horses. I think they had this idea that they were really going to expand and branch out. Things didn't quite go their way. So they ended up with just the home in Chino Hills. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. It was a nice home, and Chino Hills is a very nice area, so not too bad.
Yeah, it was a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house, family room, had a jacuzzi right outside the master bedroom. So at this point, as I said, she had been pregnant twice. They had 2 children. One was a daughter, Jessica, and one was a son, Joshua. And this Chino Hills move happened in 1975. Out there, it seemed that other people had these Arabian horses. So they were around people that were into the same thing that they were. I guess that fit their lifestyle. So let's go to the time of the murders. Saturday, June 4th, 1983. The Ryans had a tag-along, which was 11-year-old Chris Hughes. He was a friend of Josh's because there weren't that many kids around. Even though Josh was 8 at the time, his friend was 11, and they spent time together.
And he demanded that Chris come over and spend the night that night. He was just very adamant because he wanted to hang out with his friends.
And on June 4th, the Ryans and Chris Hughes went to a potluck barbecue dinner with a bunch of other Arabian horse owners and their families. They were actually at the home of George and Valerie Blade.
They'll stay there until at least 9:30, and then they'll return home back to their house. And that's the last time anyone's really heard from them.
So they believe that the Ryans arrived home at about 9:30. So the following day, remember, Chris Hughes was going to stay the night with Josh at the Ryan home. And the next day, his mother is looking for him. So she calls, but she can't get anyone to answer. I think the line was actually busy. And so she goes over to the house. You know, she doesn't get an answer. So she leaves. But then later, her husband, Chris's dad, goes and checks out the house. Well, he looks in and he sees the body of his son. And he also sees Josh. But Josh is the only one who appears to be alive. He tries to get his attention and says, "Can you please let me in?" But Josh can't speak. His mouth is moving, but he can't speak. And he's obviously been traumatized and brutalized. And so Chris's dad breaks in. He checks his son, and his son is deceased. Josh is apparently barely alive. And Mr. Hughes goes further into the house.
He tries to call for help, but the phone's not working. He assumes the line's been cut, and he'll go over to a neighbor's house seeking help and call the police from there. The police will arrive. They will say there are four DOAs, dead on arrival, but they'll have four or five paramedics working on Joshua, and they will airlift him to the nearest hospital.
The father, the mother, and their son were all in the master bedroom, and Jessica was on the floor in the hallway just outside that bedroom.
Now, Franklin, he was the only grown man in the house, and he was found on the bed. He has some defensive wounds, but most of the wounds are to his head, and we can kind of assume that he was the first one attacked, because he would obviously be the biggest threat to any assailant that's coming into the home. So he was caught off guard. Possibly he was asleep in bed when this person came in and attacked. Franklin, Doug, he had 37 wounds. Peggy had 33. Jessica had 46. And Chris Hughes had 25. A lot of these are a mix of hatchet or chopping blows, and then stab wounds or slicing wounds. There were at least two, if not three, weapons used in the attack. So we can assume a hatchet, we can assume a knife, and possibly either a ice pick or a screwdriver.
Joshua Ryan was flown by helicopter to Loma Linda University Hospital, and when he went there, there was a clinical social worker who worked with him to try and get some information. And what he did was he had a chart. He would ask Joshua to point at words or numbers on that chart because he still couldn't speak. And so by using this system, he was getting information out of Joshua that's pretty important because he's the only survivor. One of the questions was, according to the social worker, he said he asked Joshua how many people there were, and Joshua pointed to three. He then asked him if they were male, and Joshua pointed to yes. So then he asked him if they were black, and he pointed to no. So he's taking him through these questions to get a clear picture of who the attacker or attackers may have been. He got out of Joshua that there were three of them, and that they were white, and that they were all men. A county sheriff's deputy from San Bernardino by the name of Irvin Dale Sharp also interviewed Joshua, and this was on June 5th, 1983. He said it took place in the emergency room and lasted about 15 minutes. Joshua was indicating that there were three white men in the house when the killings occurred.
Now you got to realize Josh has had his head bashed in and his throat slit. So he's not in a good way. He's gone through something traumatic. And he was lying on the floor looking at his dead mother for up to 8 or 12 hours. This is a really critical time for him to relay information so they can catch the perpetrators. But at the same time, it might be a little bit traumatic for him to relay any information.
Just an hour later, with the same county sheriff's deputy, Joshua indicated that the three men were Hispanic.
And I get it. An 8-year-old might not be able to comprehend race as well when it comes to white or Hispanic. But it will be said that Joshua could have been referring to three Hispanic guys that would hang around the ranches or help out around the neighborhood. And he was familiar with these guys. So it's possible he might be referring to them.
But the deputy goes on to say that the three male suspects were not known to the victim, according to the information he got. But again, if you look at what kind of injuries that Joshua sustained, you wonder, is the information correct? Is it accurate? We just don't know. All we know is that he's maintaining that there were three men. That's certain. Now, one of the motives that might exist in this case is it could have been a robbery gone wrong, right?
Yeah.
When they go into the house and they look, they don't really see anything missing.
It's hard to tell because they don't know what's there, but it's not ransacked. It's not rifled through. And there's money that's left out in plain view. There's weapons in the house that haven't been taken.
The only thing they know for sure is that one of the cars that belonged to the Ryans is missing. It's a station wagon. As they go through the house, they start to investigate, but unfortunately, around 70 officers enter the home.
That's a lot.
You know, we always talk about preserving the crime scene and how important it is to document everything, but we've seen other cases where a lot of officers enter a home and you start to wonder if they're trampling on evidence.
Keep in mind, this is the early 80s, so they're not thinking DNA yet, but we still have fingerprints, we have footprints, we have blood evidence. There's a lot of other things that should be retained and not tainted, so it's not exactly locked down.
So they will be collecting blood, looking for any kind of fingerprints, shoe prints, weapons, any items that may have been discarded by the killer or killers. They do end up with a fair amount of evidence, I would say, in this case.
There were two guns in the bedroom. There was a loaded rifle and a loaded pistol around the bed. So if you think about the number of victims and how Doug was an ex-Marine, and then you have Joshua saying there were multiple assailants, well, how did they get the drop on this family? How did they overpower Doug? And how did Doug, why was Doug not able to get to these weapons? They're kind of putting this together. And I think it makes sense that with the number of weapons used, the number of victims, it definitely suggests that there's multiple assailants here.
Well, let's be clear, though. The weapons that you're describing were weapons that belonged in the home.
Yeah, so this would be something that Doug would defend himself with. And they were within arm's reach of the bed, but he wasn't able to get to them.
The weapons that were used against the family, though, weren't guns. They weren't firearms. They were, you know, a hatchet, a knife. And as far as who got, you know, how someone might have gotten the drop on this father who was former Marine, it makes sense if he's asleep. And if you take into account that, according to people that knew this family, they didn't lock their doors.
Yeah. And Joshua says that they heard screaming from the bedroom, and that's what brought him and Jessica and Chris up there. So it would only be Doug and Peggy in the bedroom. So at the scene of the crime, they don't find any of the weapons used in the murders. They do find some bloody footprints and obviously blood evidence on the walls and on the floor, on the bed, but nothing that's really pointing to anybody. They will end up finding a hatchet that's been discarded along the road outside of the house. So whoever committed this crime with the hatchet threw it out the window as they're driving off. There are several bloody articles of clothing found at the crime scene. There's a blue shirt and a tan shirt that have blood spots on them.
And both of those were found where they would have been discarded away from the house.
Yeah. But obviously they have blood on them, so probably connected to the crime.
They also found about 10 or more hairs in Jessica's hand.
Brown or blondish hairs, but she was clutching them in her hand. So possibly she reached out and grabbed hair from somebody, maybe the assailant.
Of course, in 1983, they don't have DNA testing. So when they test blood, they discover if it's A, if it's B, if it's AB, if it's O. They can then test and see, you know, where this blood may have come from. They can also do a test to find out the race of the person whose blood it was.
Police will also search a nearby house. It's a neighbor's house. They use it seasonally, so they're not there that often. They also rent it out to other people to use. Their first initial search of the house, they don't come up with much. And being that it's a next-door neighbor's house, they might not know what to be looking for. So we call this the lease house or the vacant house, but it's not an abandoned home. It actually has a functioning phone and things inside that home. The police will come across a sheath for a hatchet, which remarkably matches the hatchet that they would find on the road. They will also find tobacco, loose tobacco, and cigarette butts. They found a sheath for a buck knife and a blanket or sheet in the closet. Now, it's hard to tell if these things are connected to the crime or not because this is 125 yards away, but going with the hatchet being used in the murder and then finding a sheath for the said hatchet, it's kind of a tie-in here. But they'll start sort of putting it together of what they think might have happened.
Yeah, it almost appears as if someone or some people that had been in this other house went from that house to the Ryan's house and attacked them. There are reasons for this. One is between the houses, there are these burrs that are in the, you know, on the ground, and some of them ended up underneath Jessica's shirt. And not to get too graphic, but at some point during the crime, her shirt had been lifted and a knife was used on her, and whoever had done that had left some burrs underneath her shirt. But these burrs are on the ground. They're between the two houses.
Yeah, there's shrubbery and just all kinds of prickly things out here because it's sort of in the wilderness. In California out there, it's sort of in the desert.
There was a 6-pack of beer inside the Ryan's fridge. One of the cans had been removed, and then one of the other cans was actually dangling off the edge of that shelf in the fridge, and it was bloody. Well, they ended up finding an empty can from that 6-pack in between the two homes.
So whoever's done this has obviously tracked burrs from between the houses, drank beer, and used items from this home at the murder scene.
Yeah, they asked people that lived at the other house, we'll call it the lease house. They verified the items that were missing. A hatchet, an ice pick, and a buck knife.
It also appears that somebody might have rinsed off their bloody clothes or themselves at this lease house.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
There are essentially two different parts of the house. One of them they describe as the Bilbia bedroom, after a woman that had been staying there. And this is the room that they really focused on because it appeared to be the one that was used by whoever had been staying in the home unlawfully, I guess you could say. And they did use luminol in the bathroom of the Bilbia bedroom. But it was odd because the luminol hit was kind of on the walls of the shower. So it wasn't like all over the floor of it. It was around the sides. And just to be clear, luminol doesn't indicate blood necessarily. It says that it could be blood. But if someone used, say, bleach in that shower and tried to clean off the walls, well, that would cause luminol to luminesce as well. You have to do a separate test to find out whether it was actually blood or not. They also use luminol in the bathroom sink, and they get a big reaction there. And they believe that someone rinsed blood off of themselves in the sink. They also collected hairs from the shower. Some of the hairs looked kind of old, and some of the hairs looked fresher. And so they kind of separated them out because some appeared to be too old to have been connected to this case. But then some looked like they very well could have been. At least when they look at them under a microscope, they start to look like they match a couple of the victims from the Ryan's house. They also discover in the closet of the Bilbia bedroom, one is a blanket, and they find semen on it. They also find a bloody rope inside the closet. There are also some footprints and some cigarettes and some tobacco.
Now, the night of the murder, there are patrons at a local bar who will claim that they witnessed three white men that were being a little rowdy come in to order drinks, and they have blood on their clothing. I think that that's a little weird for somebody to just walk into a bar covered in blood. I would just assume that you would wash off, or you wouldn't go in a public area if you had blood all over you. But hey, this is what they're claiming they see.
Well, a woman at the bar who one of the men seemed interested in even pointed it out to him, said, "Hey, you have blood all over you." And she said his reaction was such that he didn't know that he was covered in blood.
Yeah. You know, I know some people hunt and clean animals, whatever, so it might not be a big deal, but I'm thinking this sticks out pretty badly.
And they weren't the only people to see three white men in the area.
No, there were other witnesses that claim they saw three white men driving a station wagon. We have a husband and wife who say they saw a group of men. The husband says there were three or four. The wife actually, I think, says there's four. The wife's not driving. Another witness said that they saw the station wagon driving around the next day. And then we have a third witness who says that a station wagon almost crashed into her, and she was driving with like her grandmother, and they wrote down the plate from the station wagon. Later on, the police will broadcast a description of the car with the license plate number, and this witness will claim that it's the same one that she wrote down, and she will testify to it. The station wagon that belonged to the Ryans will not be found for several days, up to a week later. And it's found in Long Beach, which is over an hour drive away from Chino.
And isn't it west of there?
Yeah, there's a beach there. You know, it's on the shoreline, whereas Chino Hills is in the desert, so it's way more east. And depending on traffic, it's quite a drive.
So the three white men that were spotted by different witnesses in a bar or in this station wagon, that's not where this ends. I mean, remember, Joshua described seeing three white men in the house when the attacks happened. So something stunning happens, though. Another witness comes forward who doesn't just have a story. She has evidence.
So this is on June 9th. Her name is Diane Roper. And she says that her boyfriend came home late at night wearing bloody overalls, and that he took off the overalls, threw them in the closet. She had put out a tan t-shirt for him to wear that night, and he wasn't wearing the t-shirt. And if you remember, a t-shirt was found at the crime scene. It happens to be the color tan or brown. So we have Diana saying that her boyfriend is part of a murderous gang, like kind of a biker gang. And around the time of the murders, he comes home all bloody. So she calls the police and actually gives them this bloody overall. She also will claim that the bloody hatchet found on the road matches a hatchet that is missing from their garage. But remember, the hatchet was actually taken from the lease house, and it didn't belong to her or her boyfriend, Lee Furrow. Lee Furrow, her boyfriend, had claimed that he had been part of this gang where he killed a girl, cut up her body, and threw her into the Kim River. And then he took plea deals, turning over state's evidence, and got a reduced sentence. Lee's not the best guy on this planet and has white friends that he hangs out with, so he's kind of looking like a good suspect here. Also, it's said that the leader of the gang he's part of had a bad deal with Peggy and some disagreement over horses or whatever it may be. And if that's true, then there's a possible motive here.
A man by the name of Kuhn, who was an associate of Furrow's, seemed to give, I guess, the story of how all this went down. I mean, he's saying he was essentially the driver and that these two other guys, one of them was Lee Furrow, went into that home to collect a debt. And it was connected to either the Brand or the Aryan Brotherhood. And so he said they went to a residence in Chino, and he said the other two guys got out, and he said that they were inside the home for about 10 to 15 minutes. And he said that one of the guys was carrying two axes or hatchets and that they had gloves on. And when they came back out, one of them said that the debt was officially collected. I would say this is further corroboration that maybe there were three men that went into that home and murdered that family, right?
My problem with this story is we know the hatchet was from the other house.
But it makes you wonder why you would have two people coming forward with stories that seem to indicate that Lee Furrow was involved in these murders, a white man.
Absolutely. And with the witness testimony of Joshua, it fits.
And the station wagon, which we talked about being found in Long Beach, was found not very far from his stepmother's house.
I mean, right here, like Joshua's witness testimony, we have three white guys. We have a stolen station wagon. They would have driven away in this station wagon. And his stepmom lives where the station wagon was found. This is open and closed, right? This is all we need.
Well, if that's the case, then these overalls would be probably the most important evidence, right? Aside from the testimony?
I would think. Be linked to the crime.
Unfortunately, these overalls are placed into a dumpster.
Well, that's not where you put evidence for a crime.
Well, I think the answer is because the police already knew who committed these murders. And it wasn't three white men.
Oh, Okay, well, now I'm confused.
Well, remember earlier we were talking about how there was evidence that the killer or killers may have traveled between this lease house and the Ryan's home. Well, it turns out, and I think part of this is due to phone calls, phone records, there was a man staying in that lease house unlawfully.
Yeah, I was going to say he wasn't exactly staying. He was holed up there. So we have a man named Kevin Cooper, and he happened to escape from a minimum security prison just close by. And Kevin himself says that he went to this house and stayed there for several days and actually made a couple phone calls to female friends of his asking them for money. So we have an escaped convict who puts himself at the crime scene in a house 125 yards away, literally puts himself there the day of the murders.
He kind of does. He admits to being there, but he doesn't say anything incriminating, really, because he ends up talking about the last phone call he makes that night. And once he's told by this woman that she's not willing to help him, which is what all the women have been telling him that he calls, he says he leaves.
And goes to Mexico.
He doesn't admit to going to the Ryan's house. He said he could see that house from the room he was staying in. And in fact, he said after the first night, he ended up holing up in the closet because he was worried that someone would spot him. He felt exposed in that room. He said that he didn't leave semen on that blanket. He said that he didn't use the bathroom. Remember, we talked about luminol being used in the Bilbia bathroom. He said he didn't use it except to test the shower. They did find his footprint in the shower.
So he's lying about everything in that house, but okay, we got it. He was there, and he was staying in the closet, and he used the bathrooms. Him saying that he never went up to that house means that he never drove away in that car either. At least that's what he's insinuating. Now, here's a little background on Kevin Cooper. He was actually from Pennsylvania. He was charged with multiple counts of burglary, and he had a pretty long rap sheet. At one point, he is accused of holding a woman at knife point and raping her. But before he can be charged for these crimes, he actually escapes custody from Pennsylvania and flees across country to California. There, he takes on a fake name and he will start breaking into houses again. And he will be caught for this and arrested and put in this minimum security prison. Now, they don't know who he is because he's not using his real name. So they don't know that he has any ties back to Pennsylvania for an attempted rape and kidnapping or charges pending. Since it's a minimum security prison and the budgets for the prison system are low, apparently there is a hole in the fence because that's just a thing. And he's able to escape this prison and walk away.
But again, it's not some elaborate plot here. He literally can walk away, and he crosses a field and ends up at the lease house.
Now, he says he is there for a very short time, and he leaves before the murders happen, and he makes his way down to Mexico. We know this is true because in Mexico, he will actually make some more phone calls asking people for help and money, but they don't oblige him. So June 2nd is when he escapes the California Institute for Men in Chino. Sheriff Floyd Tidwell of San Bernardino County says Mr. Cooper had eluded the search. Cooper had gone on to meet a couple who owned a 32-foot sailboat, Owen and Angelica Handy. So the Handys.
Yeah, this was on June 9th of 1983. So just, what, less than a week after the murders.
Which makes sense because he's fled Chino and gone south. And, you know, just so you know, from LA to the Mexican border is less than a 3-hour drive. But if you're going to take into account if you're going from Chino Hills to Long Beach and then south, it's like a 4 or 5 hour drive. But he has days to do this. But we know he does make a phone call pretty early on.
And the couple, the Handys, they describe him as having some items which, you know, at least to the investigators, sound an awful lot like the items that were missing from the woman who actually lived in the room he had stayed in. So he had taken some of her items. Some of those were some blue gloves. And he said the reason he took them was because when he made the trek to that house, he actually fell. And when he landed on his hands, he injured them a little bit. So he wanted some gloves for when he walked around in that area. So in case he fell again, he wouldn't hurt his hands.
Well, he hits it off with the Handys. He's met them in Ensenada, which is a little resort town in Baja California. And they will eventually leave port and head up to Santa Cruz Island, which is 25 miles south of Santa Barbara. And then they will go on to Santa Barbara.
And this is around July 30th, because on July 30th, a woman reports that Cooper, and that's who they end up arresting, that this man had attempted to rape her at knife point. Her boat was docked right by the Handys. Now, as he ran, he threw a knife into the water, which police did recover.
And he jumped into the water and tried to swim away, but was apprehended. So we have Kevin Cooper, who has multiple allegations of rape, kidnapping, holding people at knife point, break-ins, robberies, all kinds of stuff. Long rap sheet here. And he admits to being in the lease house right next to where these murders happened. Seems like a pretty good suspect, but he's not three white men. Now, what does tie Cooper here is, himself, by saying he was there, the tobacco that they found, they say it's roll right tobacco, which is specific to prisoners in the prison system. It's a free tobacco that they give out. Also, these footprints, they're made by a Prokhead shoe, which is the standard issue in a prison. So we kind of have some things tying him to this murder scene.
And the shoe has a unique diamond tread pattern. They find this print both at the Ryan's house and at the Lee's house.
So this is a little odd that we have this other suspect, but I mean, honestly, a guy escapes from prison and literally goes to where the murder scene is. We have evidence tying these two locations together. I understand why the cops are now saying that Kevin Cooper is their prime suspect. The neighborhood absolutely believes that he's the prime suspect because of all the evidence they've found. And at the time, early 80s, and he's a escaped convict, black man, tempers rise.
They had tested all of the blood. A little bit of the blood ended up not belonging to the victims. There was a drop of blood found on the hallway wall, which was opposite of the door to the Ryan's master bedroom where the parents stayed. It was shown to have come from an African-American male, which of course is consistent with Cooper. They also discovered through subsequent testing that they couldn't match it to anyone else other than an African-American. So they used various testing methods, including electrophoretic testing.
They also test the saliva on the cigarette butts. They'll test the blood at the home. And a lot of this stuff is pointing back to Cooper.
The defense even tries to test this blood drop, which, of course, since it's a blood drop, there's not a lot of blood there. They use a transferrin test. They were hoping that it would show that it wasn't Cooper who was the donor of this drop. But this transferrin test showed that the blood drop was consistent with Cooper's genetic profile. The blood drop did not come from any of the victims. All additional testing on this drop, it all led back to Cooper. The hatchet that they had found was tested, of course. It had blood consistent with the victim's. There were hairs on that hatchet. The hairs that were found on it were tested, and they were consistent with the hairs of both Doug and Josh Ryan. There were hairs taken from the stolen vehicle. There were hairs collected from Jessica's hand. There were tests run on the cigarette butts that were found both in the station wagon and in the lease house.
Also in the station wagon, you had rolled cigarette butts and then manufactured cigarette butts and possibly blood stains in both the front and back seat. So that would again point to multiple assailants because you have blood in the front and the back and two types of cigarettes smoked. It's not impossible that one person could have gone in the back seat to get some things, drop some blood, and then got in the front seat, smoked a cigarette, found another cigarette and smoked it too. But it's just one more thing that points to multiple people.
There was a missing pack of cigarettes from the house. Now, the hair that was found inside of the station wagon was believed to be a pubic hair from an African-American male. The saliva tests that were done on two of the cigarette butts from the station wagon were from a non-secretor, which fit Kevin Cooper. Data shows that only about 20% of the population are non-secretors.
So he's not excluded by any of this evidence that we're finding.
And the blood type of the person who smoked the manufactured cigarette butt was type A, which is also consistent with Cooper.
So the cops apprehend him in Santa Barbara trying to swim away. And this woman that reported the rape will see a wanted picture of Kevin Cooper and notify the police, hey, that's the guy. That way, police will know this is the guy wanted for the murders. Because right now, all they have him for is this arrest for this rape up in Santa Barbara. So this woman is now able to connect him to these murders. So the police will bring him back down to Chino Hills. And they will start putting this together. Now, Kevin Cooper will deny any involvement with the murders or anything with this crime, but he does admit to being in the leased house. Now, he'll go to trial for this crime, and he's charged with 4 counts of murder and 1 count of attempted murder because Joshua lived. You remember Joshua's statements were initially 3 white men. And he gave this statement of multiple assailants to up to 5 people between the counselor, investigators, nurses, what have you. Well, now he's changing his statement and saying that he actually really didn't see the assailants. And he saw a shadow and he was hit from behind and he doesn't know. And it's possible that he was referring to these 3 guys that he knew from the neighborhood or something to that effect when he was saying 3 people, but he really is backpedaling from his initial statements.
And that could make sense because the type of injuries that he sustained, especially to the head, he could have merged 2 events together, even though they don't belong together. He could have moved these 3 guys that were in the area into the crime scene. It's like, how reliable is his memory at that point?
But the police and investigators have a lot more evidence on Kevin Cooper, so they don't really need Joshua's testimony here. They don't need his statements. They have Kevin Cooper's blood droplet at the scene of the crime. They have this hatchet sheath at the house, and they have the shoe print. The shoe print's a big deal to them because it's a Proke head print, and it's literally on a sheet at the murder scene. And they're saying, well, the only shoe that could have made this specific, unique diamond, you know, print is worn by convicts in prison. And this shoe's only available to convicts in prison. It's a big thing that the prosecutor talks about.
Yeah, it's a Proke head dude shoe.
Now, Proke heads are actually readily available to a lot of people. They are standard issue at a at a prison. But the way the prosecutor makes it sound, only prisoners would be wearing this. So we have a coincidence here. We have something that lines up with Kevin. But the way the prosecutor frames it, he's wrong. Anyone can buy this shoe.
Well, and the warden, she tries informing the sheriff about this, and she makes several attempts, but it seems like they're not real receptive to her. And of course, during court, especially after court, they make this statement about how they never said it was only a prison shoe. And they make it seem like it wasn't an important point. But I don't know. The way I took it was they made it seem like, yeah, well, that print right there, that's from a prisoner. And who's our prisoner in this case?
It's like, this absolutely proves it's him. But then when we're questioned about it, we're going to kind of go soft on it.
You know, if they had just said this same print was found over at the Lee's house and then it was found here at the Ryan's house, that's a connection. Working in this whole prison thing, it really isn't important. I get that, but they made it seem important at the trial, and for them to back off of that and act like it wasn't, well, yeah, it wasn't, but you made it seem important. You know, all that's important really is that they connect this shoe print with having been both at the Lee's house and at the Ryan house, and that's really the point they should have been making. They also go on to basically discredit the warden and say that she wouldn't really know what was standard issue at the prison, which I think is funny because she's the warden.
They also say that she never tried to call them, although she has phone records proving she had. So a little disagreement on this whole shoe print thing. I think it's important to bring it up. And I think that if a shoe print does match whatever the standard issue is, it's a connection. They also collected evidence from that Lee's home. They collected a bunch of cigarette butts. It's claimed that they did not enter these things into evidence right away. And then when they collected the car, all of a sudden, there's more cigarette butts that are found in the station wagon, whereas they only found one cigarette butt at the Lee's house. But it's considered that they might have found a lot more cigarette butts at the Lee's house, and they just never entered them into evidence and then planted them in the station wagon. At least that's the argument that they're going to make.
Another argument they make is that testing on blood revealed that there was EDTA present. And if you recall the Stephen Avery case, at least early on, when Making a Murderer first came out, there was a big deal made of, oh, wow, the seal is broken on this blood vial and it appears to have been punctured, and blood could have been planted from that. But of course, as we know now, that's not really true. So, but in the Kevin Cooper case, EDTA was a big deal, and they were trying their best, meaning the defense, to test everything and try and figure out whether they could discover the presence of EDTA.
Well, this happens in 2004 on an appeal when they're doing a test on the tan shirt that was found at the scene, close to the property, and the shirt had blood from both Franklin, the father, and Kevin Cooper. Now, the problem with this whole deal and the testing on the shirt is they say that Kevin Cooper's blood has EDTA and Franklin's blood does not. It's really hard to hash this out because on the face of it, it looks like they pulled blood from a vial and deposited it or planted it on the shirt back in the 1980s. And now when they're testing the shirt in 2004 or in the 2000s, wow, looks like they planted blood on it. But EDTA is actually found in a lot of common products. And the testing of EDTA is not an exact science. So when you're testing blood for the presence of it, how much are you looking for? How much proves that it was actually from a vial as opposed to a low amount? It's almost inconsequential at that point. You can't make a lot of determinations, but it's definitely something the defense is going to point out because they wanted to have this shirt tested to exonerate or to exclude Kevin. And then it comes back as Kevin's DNA on the blood droplets. But then there's EDTA in those blood droplets. So even when they get the testing done, when it comes back to their client, they want to say, no, this isn't him.
The other problem with EDTA is since it's used to keep things in a liquid state, it's often contaminating labs. And you say contaminating. Well, if you're looking specifically for EDTA, chances are you might find it. But let's really finish with the trial before we move on and talk about the subsequent tests that were run later. The trial is not good for Kevin Cooper because while we had other suspects with Lee Furrow and the other two men, Kuhn and the other guy, they didn't find evidence from them at the crime scene. They didn't find any blood from them. They didn't find any fingerprints or shoe prints that could be tied to these guys. And they didn't find multiple footprints from these multiple assailants. All they had was evidence of someone who went back and forth from the Lee's house to the Ryan's house, and they found blood from Kevin Cooper.
And there's this idea that one person could not have killed multiple victims, especially when you have Franklin, who's this ex-Marine and he has guns nearby. And they claim that Kevin Cooper was 155 pounds and could not have overtaken him. But I mean, when I was in the military in basic training, I weighed 153. And if you give me a hatchet and tell me to go attack a guy that's laying in bed, I think I could get the drop on him at 153 pounds. And then Peggy, you'll hear that Peggy was a tough, strong woman, but a grown man with a hatchet and a knife, I think he can overpower her.
And at night.
Yeah.
I mean, they were attacked when it was bedtime.
So, you know, one person could do this. And then there's the aspect of multiple weapons were used, so it had to be multiple people. Again, yes, multiple weapons were used. I will say that it appears that the hatchet was used first to incapacitate them, and then a knife was used to finish them off, or a screwdriver or ice pick, whatever. Could be up to three weapons here. So you hit somebody over the head with a hatchet multiple times, they're not quite dead, and then you come back and you slice their throats or you stab them. And we've covered cases where one assailant has used multiple weapons, right?
If you recall, we covered the Lululemon murder case. And the woman in that case who murdered her fellow employee, she did so with six different weapons.
So we're looking at this case and I'm thinking, one guy could totally do this and use multiple weapons. This is not impossible at all. It's very plausible.
Yeah, there's a claim out there that you'll see on especially support sites for Kevin Cooper that say, how could five people be attacked, four of them killed, by one person in 4 minutes?
Well, I mean, let's define this. It's two adults and three children. Children aren't, and the children say that they heard screaming and they came to the bedroom to see what was going on. So the two adults had already been dispatched of. And in 4 minutes, well, how do we know 4 minutes? I mean, this is just this arbitrary number that they've thrown out.
Well, they get it from the medical examiner had said that each of the victims could have been killed, attacked with these weapons and killed within a minute or two. So, you know, on the short end, they're trying to say that all of these people could have been dead within 4 to 6 minutes, whatever. But really, as you said, they could have all been attacked with a hatchet. So maybe the two adults get hit with hatchet. And then are they going to be fighting anymore after getting hit two or three times in the head with a hatchet?
No.
No. And yes, he has time to go back and then hit him with the knife or the ice pick. I mean, remember, it's a buck knife or an ice pick. And these are people that have been disabled because they had a hatchet driven through their arms, through their heads, into their chests. It's a violent attack, but you can't defend yourself if you get hit like that. And so when people say, oh, well, that's not likely, No, it's very likely that one person could wield different weapons, especially if you're heading to a house and you bring different weapons with you. Why? I don't know. I've seen cases where knives break when someone's being stabbed with it. If you have multiple weapons, let's say you lose one of them, you still have a weapon. This might just be someone who's well prepared.
Yeah. And I don't think he has to use both hands. Like, there's these arguments that he's got a hatchet in one hand and a knife in another. No, you hit them with the hatchet and then you come back with the knife later. And later can be a few minutes later. It's okay. You don't have to do this in a 4-minute time span. The whole argument for that is just stupid to me. They all died within the same time frame. That's all you really need to know. You don't have to put a timestamp on it, because if one of them died a minute later, they're not going to really be able to figure that out from these autopsies.
There wasn't a police car showing up 5 minutes after the attack started.
No, it was the next day.
So whoever did this had as much time as they needed, really.
Yeah.
So you can't just say 4 minutes. You can't say 6 minutes. You can't even say 12 minutes.
Kevin says that he was on his way to Mexico, yet we have a phone call from the Lee's house at around 8 or 9 o'clock that night. So he literally puts himself there an hour before the murders if we're going off that time frame.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you? And how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/genY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/genY.
The defense tries its best to point out the problems with the investigation. They try to point out the issues with how, you know, they had a woman that was sketching out different parts of the crime scene, and there were things she didn't sketch originally that she was asked to go back and look at. So we kind of had this situation where we have shoe prints appearing later. And then with the car, when the car was originally searched, they didn't find some of the things they found on a subsequent search. It's very much like the Avery case, where there's some doubt here. Like, why would they miss this? Why would they miss that? And why all of a sudden on this cover outside the house do they suddenly have a shoe print when the woman that was sketching it didn't see it originally? There's some doubt. But try as they might, and there were problems with the investigation. We already told you 70 officers tromped through the scene. And even later when they took the house apart, they put all that in storage, but there's nothing forensically sound about what they did. Well, this jury probably thinks, there's too much doubt here, right? There's reasonable doubt. No. For one, you know, the true crime genre has kind of altered the way people think about things. And I would argue there are way more people today who are worried about sending an innocent person to prison than was the case back in the 1980s or 90s. I mean, it's changed a lot. I don't think it was until the OJ case came along where people really started questioning this stuff. So back then, with this trial, Kevin Cooper, guilty.
Yeah, he was found guilty. I mean, in fact, they had to move the trial down to San Diego because it was such big news up north. It was being racially charged against him, which is sad to see even in a... I mean, it's just sad to see that as being the primary focus of this case. I just look at, you have a terrible murder that happens and you have an escaped convict who is a violent convict placing himself right next to the murder scene. I think it's pretty easy to understand why he was the focal point of this crime. But when you hear about almost every piece of evidence not being found on the first search, but being found on subsequent searches, that puts it into question. If it's just one piece of evidence, that's fine. But it's almost every piece of evidence in this case. You almost feel as if the people that are supporting Kevin Cooper have a good point. You have two narratives here. You have he's guilty of sin, or he had nothing to do with this. And I hate it when I hear people say, you know, we're charging an innocent man with a crime and we're going to put him to death. He's not innocent. And let's rephrase that. We might be charging a man with a crime that he is innocent of, but he is not an innocent man. And that's the problem with the advocates for him, is they paint him out to be this angel who just was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And they skip over a lot of his background, a lot of the things that placed him at this house. He was literally on the run and calling people from the home. Like, it doesn't really match up. And we know that the murder moved from the Lee's house to the Ryan's house because of items that were moved back and forth, and the burrs and other things. So that really puts the spotlight on him. But we have this shirt, and it's a tan shirt. Was this shirt prison issued? So it's weird that they find this tan shirt and it's Cooper's blood and Franklin's blood on it. And then you have the whole Diane Roper situation where she's saying she gave Lee Furrow a tan shirt to wear, and then he comes home and he's not wearing it. And he takes his coveralls and throws them in the closet. She turns those over to police and they throw them away. Well, here we have this whole situation of you have somebody saying that this was his shirt, and you have someone saying that there was bloody coveralls that were tossed. And if this guy was actually the perpetrator of the crime, well, we could have tested those overalls, those coveralls. And here we have this tan shirt that does have his blood, Cooper's blood on it. But then you have the whole EDTA. Well, they still want to test the shirt, but now they want to test it for sweat in the armpits to see if that matches Kevin Cooper.
Right. So Kevin Cooper was found guilty. He was sentenced to death and it would be via gas chamber. But again, this case goes to appeal because it is a death penalty case. There are all these questions, you know, was he framed? Was blood planted? Did they just make him look guilty because he was convenient? And was Roper just trying to get revenge against a guy that she had gotten tired of? She was done with him, and maybe she wanted revenge against him. Maybe she hated him. And so she can just come up with a story. But then you have Kuhn, who supposedly was with Furrow, said what he said about that, you know, it being a hit, collecting a debt for some brotherhood. Lots of questions. The advantage of the appeals and then having to retest items over time is technology catches up. And so in the years since the trial, they can move on to DNA testing.
Another issue here with the original investigation is the lab tech who found the shoe print evidence and whatnot. He'll go on to steal heroin from the evidence room. And it's claimed that planted evidence against a William Richards in another murder trial. And he ends up getting fired for these things. So stealing heroin and planting evidence. And the sheriff, he had some stuff on him, right?
Yeah, the sheriff that was the head of the investigation, he was later busted for stealing guns from the evidence locker and then selling them.
Hmm. Confiscating guns from criminals and then turning around and selling them to criminals. Yeah. Here's my problem is, if I'm going to use all the things, Kevin Cooper's rap sheet against him, his background, his attempted rapes, his break-ins and his whole violent history against him. Well, I'm going to use that same logic and I'm going to use it against these investigators. They're stealing heroin and guns and planting evidence. I got a problem here because I'm not going to treat them any differently than Kevin Cooper. I think Kevin Cooper is the perfect person to commit this crime because of his background and his placement. And I think these guys are the perfect people to plant evidence because they've done it before. It's not a good situation to be in.
Yeah, and I would venture to say that the death penalty was inappropriate in this case. You can say it was a series of violent attacks in a home. Young people were killed. But still, there are a lot of problems here. And when I looked at the appeals and I looked at the filings that were done, there were a lot of good points raised by the defense. Now, quite honestly, most of it really doesn't help Kevin, in my opinion. It's like they're throwing a bunch of stuff out there to cloud the issue.
Like test this, test that, blah, blah, blah. But all these things, none of them really exclude Kevin. They're just trying to bring up doubt and point the finger somewhere else.
Let me go down a list because there are some things that I think are beneficial to Cooper. One is Coon's testimony. Again, he places Lee Furrow and himself at the crime scene. That's testimony, not evidence. There is the question of two different shirts being found. Now, we didn't really go into this a lot, but the police supposedly had gotten a blue shirt. The blue shirt fits standard prison issue, okay? But this shirt went missing.
What? Just...
And it was bloody, right? So if there were two shirts discarded that were both bloody and both could be tied back to this crime scene, does that indicate multiple attackers? Maybe, right?
Yeah.
We talked about the poor forensics in this case. I mean, just taking the cover that was outside the home that had a shoe print on it. I believe it was a partial shoe print. And like I said, the woman that was sketching what she saw didn't see that till later. I mean, this goes for a lot of the evidence. The tobacco evidence that was found at the Lee's house, it was said that the police didn't record the evidence in a way that would show that they maintained the same number of items they collected throughout. So in other words, yeah, we found some cigarettes, but then it wasn't weighed. It wasn't recorded in a way that they could prove that none of it was planted in the car, right? Because on the first search of the car, there were some things they didn't find right away. I mean, it's a car. How do you miss stuff like this? The possible planting of blood because of the EDTA levels. I think the EDTA is kind of a difficult thing to rectify because the standards for testing would be established by what, the FBI? I mean, anytime I've read anything to do with EDTA, no one seems to agree. They even had 3 months of hashing this out for the Cooper case. They couldn't come to an agreement of any kind of standards there. In the end, it sounded like the EDTA levels were still kind of low. So I don't know. You can say it means something and you're welcome to that opinion, but it's not anything earth-shattering.
Also, the deputies claim that they hadn't gone into the leased house before. And then when they go in there and they find the tobacco and the hatchet sheath, it's kind of figured out that one of the deputies' fingerprints was found inside the closet. So they'd lied. They had been to the Lee's house. So are they lying because they didn't have a warrant to go search? Or are they planting evidence? Of course, the defense is going to take this as evidence planting.
You have Joshua Ryan's inconsistent recollection of what he saw the night that the attacks happened. First, it was white men. Then it was Hispanics. Then it was, I think I saw a shadow. At one point, I think he even said he saw a puff of hair on the person's head who had their back to him when he was looking into the master bedroom. You also had a situation where, you know, when Kevin Cooper was taken in, they collected blood from him and they put it into a vial of blood and marked it VV2. It just so happened that years later, they sent the hairs in for mitochondrial DNA testing. Okay. They wanted to see who the hairs belonged to or may have belonged to. Well, whoever sent the hairs also sent a sample of the blood that came from the VV2 vial. because it was marked as such. This is a sample of it. It's not the whole tube, of course. Well, they decided, you know, this lab person, this scientist decided to test the DNA from the blood and found that there were two DNA profiles in it, which should not be, right? If they pulled blood from Kevin Cooper, put it in a vial and labeled it, it should be one DNA profile, not two.
So let's unpack this. The hair was tested, but it came back as the Ryan's family. So that doesn't exclude anyone that's not from the attacker. But this blood vial has two DNA profiles, which means it's been totally tainted, which means that we can't believe anything that these tests are saying now, because are they using his blood to deposit other places? What are they doing with this blood vial? And if there's two profiles, well, even if this wasn't malicious, it's tainted, it's contaminated, and we can't go with this.
The idea is if they use blood to plant, you know, they're sprinkling blood here or there, and then the blood level goes down, well, now they might have to add other blood to it, right? That's the idea. There's also testimony, and this was for trial, from an inmate named Taylor. Taylor was saying that he's the one who gave Cooper the tennis shoes. There are some issues with this because his testimony is very inaccurate. There are times where he says that the Keds are the same as some other brand. Then other times he confuses the two, and then he benefited from his testimony. Also, there was money in plain sight. Now, I was actually sitting with Justin when we looked this up, and there is an image from the crime scene where you can see money, which involves bills and change, stacked up, and it remained in clear view of whoever committed these murders, and it wasn't taken. So Kevin Cooper, who had been making calls asking for help from different women, obviously needed money, but he didn't take any money from the crime scene, which means if this was collecting a debt, i.e. some people needed to die, maybe those people wouldn't have wanted the money that was in the house. Well, maybe it wasn't Kevin Cooper. So far, in all these years since the trial and everything, Kevin Cooper remains in prison and he remains on death row. And that's because every time that they've tested anything or, you know, he's had an appeal to the courts, things have not worked out for him. But he has a lot of supporters. Let's talk, though, about what makes him look guilty.
Well, first, I think that he could have done this on his own. They say that the car, the keys were in the ignition. So why would Kevin go into the house and wipe out a whole family if he was just going to steal a car? Well, how would he know the keys are in the ignition? I mean, if I'm going to go steal a car, I might just go into the house first to get the keys, because I'm not going to assume that they're in the ignition. It's here nor there to me.
Yeah, it's possible that most criminals would go and check the car first to see if they could gain access. But that doesn't mean that that's what Cooper had to do. Also, why does he have to worry about just stealing a car? This guy's a violent criminal. What if he decided to just murder the people in the house? Why isn't that brought up?
Yeah. As far as the money that's laying out, he just wiped out a whole family. Maybe he's just wanting to get the heck out of there. He doesn't want to stick around because he just murdered people. He just wants to flee, escape the scene. I think that if you just wiped out what you think is five people, including three children, you might not look for money laying out. You might not steal that. You might be in a heightened state and want to take off. Now, the shirt really bothers me because we have the blue shirt that he should have been wearing, but is lost. And then you had the tan shirt. The tan shirt wouldn't have been prison issue. So it makes more sense that it would belong to Lee Furrow. But if I'm going to go with the Lee Furrow idea, you have three guys showing up in their own car, murdering a family. And then what? Then they're going to go over to this other house next door, hang out, and then come back and steal the Ryan's car too?
Yeah, I think this is the most damning thing, actually. I know we could talk about forensics and how they found DNA that they linked to Kevin Cooper after he requested it be tested. But really, I think the car is the key here, because these guys, if they drove up in a car and did this hit and then left, they don't need the Ryan's car. Kevin Cooper needs a car. He needs that more than anything else at this point. He needs to get out of there.
Long Beach is kind of on the way to Mexico. So even though Lee Furrow's stepmom lives in Long Beach, it makes sense for either one of them to drive there and dump the car.
Why is it that he has to drive immediately to Mexico? He could have driven over to Long Beach first.
Yeah, he has plenty of time to make it to Mexico and make that other phone call. I think back to that initial blood droplet at the Ryan's house, and that wasn't planted. That was photographed. They found it initially. It didn't show up later. And it came back as Kevin's. So the shirt, I think the shirt looks a little funky. And I kind of throw the shirt thing out because of the EDTA and whatnot. But that initial blood droplet, not so much.
Yeah, I think if we're just going to ask, who do we think did this? It's easier to come up with Kevin Cooper, because there is zero evidence, okay? You can talk about testimony all day long to me. You can say, oh, this person said that. This person claimed this. Just look at the forensics. What did they have? If you just take this one blood droplet, it is a million times more important than the missing forensics for any three guys you're trying to tell me about.
That's the problem, is I can't deny that they didn't plant evidence. I can't deny that there wasn't missteps here, but all the evidence is coming back. And then to further debunk the Lee Furrow thing is, okay, you have Kuhn saying, oh, well, we went up there with weapons, but we know that the weapons were used from the lease house, because the owners of the lease house said, no, that hatchet was ours. That buck knife was ours. So that debunks the whole Kuhn testimony of, we went there, we had hatchets on us. No, you didn't.
Yeah, I mean, all this stuff can be argued. And I understand when people say, well, they could have collected things and dropped them off there to make it look like it came from there. And they could have asked these people to lie because we need to get the right guy behind bars. But really, between the car and the blood droplet, if I have to pick, I would have to say Cooper. But on the flip side of this whole thing, if you are bothered by any kind of possible wrongdoing on the part of the sheriff's department here, by the investigators, then by all means complain, because our system needs some criticism. The only way we're going to improve our justice system is to constantly keep it in check. Just don't try to tell us that this guy's innocent, because he's a rapist, okay? He's a rapist. He's a violent criminal, and he had all the motive in the world to at least want to take this car, if not kill these people. But yeah, keep the system in check, well, by all means.
We don't live in a black and white world. You don't have to be on one side or another. You know, I think of, you know, people root for their local sports team, even if they suck. They don't have to be winners. I think you can think this guy is totally guilty while simultaneously thinking the investigation was horrid, evidence could have been planted, prosecution's theories are all wrong. We can have it both ways. You can think someone's guilty, but also think the system and prosecution of the person was so botched that they deserve an appeal, a retrial, or even to walk free. Which, yeah, you can think someone's guilty and think they can walk free because the investigation was so bad. You can do that. You don't have to be on one side or another. The state has the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The onus is on them to get their theory right, get the evidence tested, and give the public faith in the system that our tax dollars are paying for. You know, that's it. It's not that hard of a concept to grasp. I don't understand how Lee Furrow and his gang would go and murder this group and then go next door to a neighboring house and then wash up or whatever, but then show up at a local bar covered in blood. Like, this Lee Furrow theory just does not add up to me at all.
Yeah, and where are all these footprints? Even if you say just two of them went in, how come we don't have multiple shoe prints that they're looking at here? They're not.
And they stole the car.
Yeah, what are they doing with the car? And why didn't they take the truck too? If there are three of them, they could have taken both the cars.
I mean, it's a station wagon, so it's not really like they're going to go sell it. And they dumped it. So if it was the whole, they owed us money, well, take the car to a chop shop or something. You know, monetary value of the from the car, if that's the case. But again, you like you said, Kevin Cooper is the one that had motive to take the car and get to Mexico. And he especially has motive to get to Mexico because he just slaughtered an entire family. I would flee to Mexico too.
Yeah, the room he was in, he had a view of the Ryan's home. You know, there's a point where Justin and I were talking about this case, and he just said, I mean, what are the odds that you have this violent criminal next door and that he had nothing to do with this?
It's, I went into this case thinking this guy looks guilty all day long. But then as I looked at the missteps of the investigation and the narrative of the innocence advocates, it really made me question, like, wow, this is really screwed up. And maybe it is this Lee Furrow guy. But when you try to put that Lee Furrow theory, when you really try to test it out, it doesn't add up. As much as a lot of this evidence being planted kind of does add up, so does an escaped convict committing this crime in such close proximity and fleeing.
Yeah, a desperate man.
When you have an escaped convict who places himself near the crime scene, has evidence strewn about between the crime scene and where he was staying, I don't really think that their focus on him was racially motivated anymore. I think it was evidence-based. So as far as all these other people that have witness testimonies, whether it be Joshua or people in cars or people at a bar, I kind of disregard them because we know witness testimony is kind of the least reliable source of evidence we have.
And when you talk about wrongful convictions, and especially when it comes to black men, African Americans, a lot of it is due to misidentification because of eyewitness testimony. We talk about, you know, what kind of evidence we're dealing with, and people are always saying, oh, it's circumstantial. Well, guess what? It turns out that circumstantial works a lot better than eyewitness testimony. Why? Because a lot of times people don't know what they're looking at or what they're recalling, especially in a case like this when Joshua was brutalized and we're expecting him to remember exactly what he saw. I'm surprised he lived.
Yeah, I'm happy he lived, and I'm happy he's grown up and he's a healthy man now, and he's a surfer and rides motorcycles, motocross, dirt bikes. What is Joshua's opinion on Kevin Cooper and all these appeals and whatnot?
It seems to me, at least, that he blames Kevin Cooper for what happened, that he believes Kevin Cooper is who attacked and murdered his family and his friend.
He blames himself for inviting his friend over. He feels guilt. His grandmother had to raise him. And for the longest time, he thought one person couldn't do this. But he absolutely felt that Kevin Cooper was involved, but maybe Kevin had escaped with somebody else. But after they did the testing, the blood testing, and then the testing on the hair, he's pretty much like, oh, okay, that answered my question for me.
Yeah, if you just look at all the forensics, and the defense has had chances to test some of this stuff too. I know you can go through and find certain things. Oh, I wish we could have tested this, and they claim we ran out of this. But really, when you look at it, they never found any forensic evidence of these supposed white men. They only found forensic evidence from Kevin Cooper.
My thoughts on Kevin Cooper is, how unlucky could you be that, I mean, there's just way too many coincidences here for me to buy into the innocence narrative, especially when, if it wasn't Kevin, then you have to accept that it was Lee Furrow, which that theory just does not pan out. It's really hard to prove that law enforcement planted evidence. It's not something that's just, oh, you know, you can throw it out there. They just planted it. But one can only insinuate, due to the somewhat questionable nature of the evidence discovery, evidence destruction, and testing. If this happened today, I don't think we would have a lot of these questions that we do because it was from the past. I don't think we would have the same level of corruption or issues with the testing because it's done in a more independent manner.
At one point, the defense made a big deal out of how this deputy said that he tossed away these overalls. He decided to get rid of them. The defense found out that this was actually signed off on by his superior officer, a man with the initials KS. And this guy didn't admit to it for a long time until the defense actually sent a former law enforcement guy to go talk with him. And what he found out from KS, which was, yeah, those were my initials. I signed off on that. Because remember, if you're going to throw away evidence, that's pretty serious, right? But if you have a superior officer signing off on it, well, you went and got permission to do it. So it's a whole different thing. You could say the guy shouldn't have done that, but he got permission to do it. So you could say the blame's on KS. But you know what KS also told this person that was looking into it? He said, if you're looking to help out Kevin Cooper, you're barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, and this is the problem with the questionable evidence and destruction of evidence is when you go back and you question them, what's going on with this, they get really hostile and they shut down the interviews and whatnot. And it sucks because I want everything to be tested. If Kevin Cooper is raising his own money to have DNA testing done, then it's not really a waste of time for the state to test things because it's not on their dime. It's not on the taxpayer's dime. And because there's so much questionable stuff here between evidence being found later, exculpatory evidence not being handed over to the defense, and destruction of evidence that was never tested. we can take the time, especially when a man's life is on the line on a capital murder charge.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.